dead, the others unable to fire effectively against such a massive assault. Ace met the wall.
Now! Let's find out!
Reached through an arrow hole to snatch the end of one man's Zinkal.
What kind of coward?
The surprised archer fired his weapon into the floor as Ace grabbed hold of his arm with both hands and yanked it forward.
Hides in a wall!
The man's unseen body slammed against the inside of the wall, shaking the structure. Ace yanked again, smashing the body repeatedly against the wall. And with one final pull, a large section of the flimsy false wall broke free, and Ace pulled an unconscious body through the rubble. Ace jumped through the newly made hole, surprising the archers on the other side.
You're all under arrest!
The small room was much plusher than the one outside. It was decorated with tapestries and cushions. There was an open window on the far side, and Ace briefly caught a glimpse of Lachlan's Kirstian face slipping out of the room and down a rope ladder.
Lachlan, don't move!
Drown in sweat, Kate!
The archers around Ace reacted, pulling their arms out of the arrow holes to point at her.
Kill her!
Her own weapon was already raised, however, and she fired an arrow point blank into the nearest archer's eye. Ace ducked, hearing Zinkaline releases stutter from either side as the archers foolishly shot at one another.
You shot me!
Ace rolled to the side, whipping her sword from its sheath. The shiny black carapace blade found its place in a second archer's chest as the man realized his Zinkal's three shots had already been expended. A moment later, the fight was over. Her insane assault had forced the archers to stop firing at her tracts, and seconds afterward, Ace's well-trained men had regrouped and followed her through the hole.
You're outnumbered, my friends. And outgunned.
Okay. We give up. Just don't shoot us.
Deal with them.
Ace charged across the room to the open window where the ladder waited.
I saw Lachlan. I'm in pursuit.
Ma'am, I...
But Ace was already gone, leaping through the window and swinging recklessly down the ladder in pursuit of her real quarry. Elsewhere, on a rowboat approaching the Khazar docks, Iador the boatman looked up as his passenger muttered something to himself.
You know, you're a fool for coming back.
You okay, buddy? Travel sick, maybe?
The passenger ignored Iador. He stood at the front of the small rowboat, heedless of its rockings, staring at the approaching city of Khazar.
It's so hot on this side. You hate heat. And all that sand getting into your shoes and your lungs, it's horrible.
Iador continued to row.
Sure, buddy. Whatever you say.
His passenger was definitely an odd one. His skin marked him as Losandin, but he spoke as if he'd been out of the country for some time. He had curly brown hair that sat like a disheveled mop on his head, and he was a bit overweight. His clothing was very irregular. It resembled the things that Iador had seen Darksiders wearing in the marketplace, constructed of many layers of cloth, and the bottom piece was divided like leggings, but not as tight. There were strange clasps and buckles everywhere. Darksider clothing had always confused Iador. Why wear something with so many pieces when a robe worked just as well?
Of course, you have a noble purpose in coming. We haven't seen Kenton in 3 years, and he was once your best friend. Too bad he's dead. Of course, you always said becoming a Sandmaster was a bad decision.
Sandmaster?
Quietly, Iador made a Kareen sign warding against evil. He wasn't Kirstian, but he was a God-fearing man. He suspected he should have refused to ferry this stranger.
Well, I suppose you can still pay your respects at his funeral. Maybe there'll be food.
You'll stop, my friend.
Iador pulled the boat into the docks, moving as quickly as he could, for he was eager to release his passenger.
Huh?
The man didn't comply with Iador's sense of urgency, stretching leisurely, then reaching behind to pull out a strange dark side cloth bag he hung by a strap from his shoulder.
Here. Thanks for the conversation.
No problem.
With that, the man stepped from the little rowing boat and onto the jetty. leaving Iador to make the Kareen symbol against evil once more.
Hey, what conversation?
Maybe the money was tainted, too.
I'll risk it.
Meanwhile, Senior Tracked Ace was running through the crowded market at the dockside, black carapace sword in hand.
Move! Get out of the way! Official business!
Up ahead, the paunchy figure of Lachlan ducked into an alleyway leading away from the busy market.
Move! Move!
Ace halted at the mouth of the alleyway, pressing her back to the wall as she peered warily down it.
So, Randar Lachlan, there's nowhere left to run.
There's always somewhere to run, Ace. Filthy Zetcha.
As if to emphasize his point, Lachlan sent a Zinkal bolt hurtling down the alleyway. It missed Ace's head by barely an inch. Ace darted into the alley, her left arm raised, with her wrist-mounted Zinkalin used as a shield. Lachlan faced her from the far end, a permanent sneer of cruelty on his scarred face. He was armed with a Zinkalin on his left wrist, but he drew a narrow-bladed black sword from a sheath at his hip, ready to meet Ace's attack.
Haven't you lost enough men today? Your raid was a bloodbath!
Ace brought her sword to meet with her opponents. Parrying blow for blow.
You've murdered three Tracts. Do you think I would turn a blind eye to that? Do you think any Tract would? Now tell me where your master is. Who are you working for?
Where is Sherzan?
You enforce a law that favors God's eternal adversary, Zetcha. And what's more... You are weak!
As their swords met, Lachlan shot an arrow from his Zinkalin down through the fleshy part of Ace's thigh, and with it, Ace fell.
I've met children with more skill, Tracked Ace. This is what you betrayed your people to become?
I serve only justice, Lachlan, and justice belongs to the Sandlord.
The criminal brought his sword down again, and Ace was lucky to parry the blow with her Zinkalin.
Fool. You're a traitor to your people. A naive traitor. So lost you can no longer tell which way the desert wind is blowing. A traitor to your heritage, to your people, to their future.
No!
The brute lashed at her again. Wrapping Ace across her sword arm, causing her to drop her blade.
Weak and out of control. Fighting for authorities and laws that are an abomination to God himself.
He stepped back then, bringing his sword down toward her head.
You are a disgrace, Tracked Ace. I give you now to the Sandlord's judgment.
As he spoke, Lachlan tore the Daikin symbol from her forehead.
You don't deserve to wear this. Zetcha.
Excuse me.
Lachlan turned at the stranger's voice, and so did Ace. A man stood in the shadows at the end of the alleyway, leaning against the wall, dressed in a mismatched Darksider wardrobe, a bag of his belongings slung over one shoulder. It was the same man who had arrived on the dock a few minutes before.
What?
Now, I realize it's probably none of my business, but don't you think the poor lady has had enough for one day? I mean, I'm a strong proponent of humiliating Tracts and others in authority, but killing them is a bit extreme.
This is none of your business.
No? Shall we ask the lady what she thinks?
Fool! If you wish to fight me, stranger, then I accept your challenge.
In an impressive display of prowess, Lachlan used the tip of his sword to flip Ace's own sword across to the man. To his surprise, the stranger caught it effortlessly.
Black carapace, sharpened to... perfection. Impressive. Thank you, but I'll decline. Swords and I don't get along very well together.
You poked your nose in. I don't think you have much of a choice now.
Lachlan pounced forward, driving his blade at the man in a precise strike. But the stranger stepped aside, seemingly without effort.
Ha! Indeed.
Dropping his bag, the stranger sidestepped another attack from Lachlan. A smug smile on his face. Ace didn't know who the stranger was, but as she lay there gathering her wits, she mentally thanked the Sandlord for the man's arrival. Incredibly, Lachlan was being outclassed. The stranger stood leaning leisurely against the alley's other wall. The assassin struck again. But again, the stranger somehow wiggled past his blade.
Stop dancing and fight!
You wanted to fight, remember? I just came to dance. And maybe eat after. Yes, that would be a wise decision. Always listen to your stomach.
Slowly, Ace slipped a small Zinkal arrow from the quiver tied to the back of her belt and loaded it into the front of her weapon. Lochmullen was attacking continuously now, fencing with the stranger like one would an armed opponent. Yet the stranger continued to keep just barely out of the sword's path. The weapon wove and sliced, sometimes coming close enough to the stranger that Ace could hear its tip tear at the soft dark side cloth.
Mm-mm-mm. You'll need to try a little harder than that, my ruddy-faced friend.
Lochmullen never drew blood, however.
Curse you! Stay still!
And where would be the fun in that? We'd both get bored if I just stood still.
And then the stranger pulled an odd feint, jumping forward instead of backward, and catching Lochmullen's weapon in one hand.
Aha!
What?
The move put the two men face to face, one confused, the other smiling happily. The stranger released the weapon an instant later, and with his opponent overbalanced, proceeded to slam the heel of his boot into his opponent's foot. Lochmullen dropped his sword. Such was the pain and surprise. The stranger nodded cheerfully to Ace, who had just finished pumping her Zinkal. Ace raised the weapon, pointing it threateningly at the disarmed assassin.
Eric's first rule of combat, my friend. Always go for the toes.
With that, the stranger picked up his pack, waved farewell to Ace, and strolled back toward the street.
My foot! It crushed
Do not move, thief! Zensha or not, I can assure you that I will not hesitate to kill you. Understand?
Yes! Just please find someone who can look at my aching foot!
Kenton rushed along the riverbank, the Darksiders forgotten for the time being. Now that he was so close to the Sandmaster's home, his eagerness was taking control of him.
That merchant said people survived the ambush. A dozen, at least. But who?
The DM itself wasn't in Khazar, but on the lake shore, a short distance away from where Kenton had dropped off the Darksiders. He made the trip quickly, barely letting himself wonder who would be dead and who would be alive. Soon he topped a small hill, and his eyes fell on the DM itself. He paused for a moment, despite his anxiety, to stare at the building that he had called home for the last 8 years.
So you're still standing, then?
Large and fortress-like, the building that was the DM seemed to be part of the sand surrounding it. And in reality, such wasn't far from the truth. The building was an enigma. It was older than the Sandmasters, or at least their formal organization. It had been formed from a single enormous block of white sandstone. Yet unlike normal sandstone, the DM's walls and floors could not be chipped or torn away. It was permanent, eternal. Kenton stood, the ever-present wind ruffling his robes, bringing with it the familiar scents of Kersdian cooking and lake water. The sun sat about 20 degrees down from the apex, resting in its familiar place. The place that felt right. The Sandmaster's power, like the building before him, had seemed eternal. They had been broken, betrayed, and destroyed through the warping of their own powers. It was possible that not a single one of them had made it back. He had been attacked again in the desert. Maybe they had too. He hadn't considered that until now. Maybe none had survived.
No, not that. Anything but that.
Kenton descended toward the block-like DM. He walked straight up the road toward its front, striding up its sandstone steps and through the doorless gate. The DM was silent. Kenton stood in the entry hall, a massive open room that stretched up for 2 stories. The room was bright. Besides the inner hallways, there wasn't a place in the DM that didn't have windows. But for some reason, it felt dark. Rich tapestries swung on the walls, giving way before the wind. Paintings watched him. The murals on the back wall, depictions of Lausanne's 8 professions, seemed faded and subdued. The ground, like all of the DM's floors, was covered with a few inches of white sand.
Hello?
This chamber was the DM's main entryway, and it had always been busy. Whether it had been acolytes running toward their rooms or undermastrels yelling for them to act properly, the entry chamber was a place for meeting and socializing. With thousands of DM members, there was always at least someone there. But now it was empty.
Is anybody here?
Kenton took a step forward, walking tentatively as if he were on deep sand. Beyond the entry chamber, he entered the dark inner hallway. Unlit lamps lined the walls, but several open chamber doors provided some light.
It's empty. Dead.
He couldn't say it, but the thought came regardless.
Like my powers.
The inner hallway extended tunnel-like in either direction, the occasional open door lending it a ghostly, quiet light. The hallway circled the rectangular perimeter of the DM. The DM's center was a large open courtyard, and from it one could reach every room on the ground floor.
Hello!
The hallway should have been lit. It was the main area of traffic in the building. Now alarmed, Kenton chose a direction and began to stride down the hallway, throwing open doors as he moved. He passed the large conference room that sat behind the entry chamber and moved on to the smaller rooms that lined the hallway on both sides. He exposed living chambers and classrooms alike, each one empty.
Can anyone hear me? It's me, Kenton!
Kenton searched frantically until he found himself back where he had begun. He had traveled the entire perimeter of the DM.
Impossible!
It's impossible.
He had wandered back into the entry hall. The DM was empty. He couldn't know for certain, of course, for he couldn't check the two upper stories. The DM had no stairs. Those who didn't have sand-mastering ability couldn't visit the chambers of the Mastrels and other high-ranking sandmasters. One needed to be able to lift oneself on sand ribbons to do so. Still, Kenton knew that even if he could get up to those floors, he would find the rooms empty. They would have heard him. Someone would have. But only ghosts and memories remained.
Father. Then, I'm the last.
The last Sandmaster. The other survivors must have been killed, and without Bayon's formidable pistols to protect them, they had likely been easy pickings, as powerless as he was. And so, he was the last Sandmaster. A Sandmaster who could no longer master the sand he touched. It was like a terrible joke. What would he do? Could the DM continue with one member? Kenton slumped against a sandstone wall, letting himself slide down to the floor.
No. No.
No!
He stared forward sightlessly, disbelievingly. How many times had he wished that he didn't have to deal with the Mastrels? How many times had he speculated about how much could be done for the DM if the old leadership were gone? He had fought them for 8 years, but now there was no one left to fight.
It's over. Finished.
No one to tell him he wasn't good enough. No one to snicker behind his back as he passed. No one to impress with how much he could do with a single ribbon. No one to meet for lunch to talk about how far they had come. No one to be his friend, despite their difference in ranks. No brothers or sisters left, spiteful or encouraging. Kenton's head fell to his hands.
What am I going to do?
Kenton, is that you?
Kenton looked up with shock, bumping his head against the wall behind him. Standing in the large gateway was a familiar form.
Dirin?
The flame-haired boy rushed into the room. He wore his Sandmaster's robes and the white sash of an acolyte.
Kenton, you're alive! We thought for certain that...
We? There are others?
Well, yes, of course. Oh, but you wouldn't know, would you?
Kenton leapt to his feet.
Where, Dirin? Where is everyone?
At the hall. Are you all right?
The Hall of Judgment? Why?
The Taishan counselors have met, Kenton. They need to ratify a new Lord Mastral.
Who will they...
Dryal.
Oh, the 100 idiots take me as one of their own. Of course it would be Dryal. He's been pushing for this ever since the day he was accepted into the DM.
Tear sent me to get this.
Dirin showed the golden sash he had folded in his bag.
We're going to give it to Dryal when he leaves the hall. It wouldn't be right for the Lord Mastral not to have one.
You won't need it.
But...
Come on, Dirin. We have a Taishan meeting to interrupt.
Before long, Kenton and Dirin were hurrying along the banks of the river through a small suburb of Khazar, populated by low buildings that were mostly residential in nature.
None of the Mastrels survived, except maybe Dryl, who isn't quite a Mastrel anymore.
How did you survive?
I don't know, really. After the Lord Mastrel's final attack, the Caerdzians only fired a few more arrows, then retreated. Most of them ignored the Acolins. Over half of us survived. The higher ranks, though.
We must have known which sash colors to aim for. It was like we were wearing targets. Wait here.
A boatman, a Lysandan with dark enough hair that he might have had some Kersdian blood in him, approached as Kenton strode forward.
Help you, sir.
We need passage to the city as quickly as possible.
Too lack. I'll have you there in less than 5 degrees.
Kenton had given all of the money to Chris and the others, assuming he wouldn't need it once he returned to the DM.
No money, huh? No ride.
Kenton watched the man turn back to tending to his docked boat. Always before, he had been able to request money from the DM for whatever expenses he had. What did he do if there was no one to distribute money? Then, reaching down to his belt, Kenton realized something.
Wait!
The man turned, and Kenton pulled out the golden Mastrel sash. The man's eyes opened wide, then immediately turned down toward the ground, and he fell to one knee.
Keen, too.
It was a mark of respect, the Kersdian word for master.
I did not know. I thought, heard, you were all too...
Everywhere Kenton looked, people averted their eyes, some bowing, others scurrying away, and more than a few making Kersdian wardings against evil with their hands. Kenton watched it all with a measure of shock. People had been suspicious of him when he was an Acolant, but he had never received a reaction such as this. Mastrels rarely left the DM, and when they did, they traveled by carriage. Kenton had not realized what an effect the golden sash would have on those around him. The boatman remained kneeling before him, sweat on his brow, his arms shaking slightly.
Please, get up. I still need passage.
Yes, King Two. Immediately.
The man hopped up, turning to his small boat.
Dirin, we're leaving.
Yes, Kenton. I'm coming. Kenton, why imitate a Mastrel? You know the punishment for that. I mean, I know you want to get to Khazar.
I'm not imitating. Dirin, the Lord Mastrel himself gave me this sash right before the attack. Weren't you paying attention?
Of course I was, Kenton, but... Well, you wouldn't know, because you always walk right up to the front. The rest of us can't do that.
Watch your step, King Two.
It's very hard to hear in the back. The lower ranks never know what's happening up front. Many of us are too short to see. I heard that you'd picked up Dryol's sash and taken it for yourself. But no one actually thought. I mean, the Lord Mastrel said he would never...
Kenton sat dumbfounded as the boat crossed the water toward the center of Khazar. The last days had been so chaotic that it was hard to remember. He knew that Lord Praxton had told him to pick up the sash, given him those quiet words of warning. But had he ever announced Kenton's advancement to the rest of the DM?
Dirin, who besides students survived the attack?
Some underfens... couple dozen fens, and 14 DM fens.
So few. So very few.
And all of them would, like Dirin, have been so far back that they wouldn't have been able to see or hear the advancement.
I was advanced, but there's no one alive who can prove it.
Except Dryl. He was close to the front.
I suspect Dryl's memory may be selective.
Ah. Oh, I almost forgot. Aloran survived too, but...
Elorin was there, right up at the front. He saw.
But, well, he isn't here.
Why not? He should be leading the DM. He's the highest-ranking Sandmaster left.
He's not a Sandmaster anymore. He overmastered like everyone who died, but his powers were burned away. He can't even master a single ribbon.
Elorin burned out? Surely he can't have...
He was the one who organized the refugees and led us back to Khazar. But once he got there, he left. He said the sight of the DM was too much for him, now that he had lost so much.
We all have, Dirin.
Land ho!
The boat pulled into dock. The dockman hopped out, quickly tying the moorings. Then he bowed subserviently as Kenton and Dirin climbed out.
Steady does it, Kenton.
Yes. Forgot myself for a moment.
The boatman demanded no payment, but instead boarded his vessel in silence. Kenton noticed a look of relief on his face as he rowed away from the city. Relief and something else, something carefully hidden. Resentment.
Come on. We need to get to the Hall of Judgment.
Yes, of course. It's this way.
The Hall of Judgment was a massive pyramidal structure. Cut from dark black marble, it was the organizational center for Lausanne's tracts and judges, much in the same way that the DM had quartered the Sandmasters. There was a massive crowd around its front steps, many of them wearing the white robes of Sandmastery, and even from a distance, Kenton could feel their anxiety. The selection of a new Taisha, leader of one of Lausanne's 8 professions, was a very important event, especially when that Taisha was the Lord Mastral. A busker played as they passed, hoping to elicit a few lakh from the crowds.
Confusion delights in its spin. Turning and turning, it finds its way in. But do not despair as it spins you around. For turn enough times and you'll see. What's lost is now found.
Kenton hung back from the crowd, waiting in the half-shadows beside an earthen building. He leaned against the hardened clay, feeling oddly hesitant after his rush to arrive.
What's wrong, Kenton?
The crowd's too thick. We'll never pass through.
People will have to move. Let's ask them. Excuse me. Make way, please. Please excuse us.
Kenton held back. He had put the golden sash away after leaving the docks. The people's reactions had made him uncomfortable. In all his years of seeking the golden sash, he had never associated it with the power that most Sandmasters probably coveted. He had wanted to be a Mastral primarily to prove his father wrong. Now that he had it, he was seriously considering throwing it away. He could do it. No one alive had heard Praxton advance him. Others might call him a fool for doing so, but Kenton had seen the faces of the Sandmasters who had been at the front of the crowd that day. He had felt their envy and their indignation. He didn't deserve the sash, and they all knew it. And then there was the reaction of the locals, the fearful respect in the boatman's bearing. Fear, envy. Is this how Mastrals were viewed?
Kenton, are we going to go forward?
I don't know, Darren.
But you have to stop Dryl. They're going to make him Lord Mastral.
How can you be so sure?
The Underfen over there said he's the only one the Taishan let in. He's in there now.
Then maybe Dryl should be Lord Mastral. He is the most powerful after all.
But you said...
I did.
Kenton, please.
I know Dryl far better than you. We were acolytes together. He'll make a despot of a Lord Mastral. I couldn't think of a worse choice, no matter how powerful he is. The problem is, I don't see what we can do about it.
But Kenton, you're a Mastral. You should be Lord Mastral.
I thought you didn't believe me.
I didn't hear Lord Praxton advance you, but I believe you. If you said he gave you the sash, then he did. Besides, you're right. Anyone would be better than Dryl.
Should I be flattered?
You deserve this. I've seen how hard you work. You do more with one ribbon than another Sandmaster can do with 5. That should be the requirement for becoming a Mastral. Not the inborn strength of your mastery, but what you do with it. These past weeks, Dryl has been lording it over us like a king from the Rimlands. He's been talking about hiring us out as mercenaries. Even with his demotion, he is still the highest-ranking Sandmaster alive. Except for you. Everyone in the DM respects you, Kenton. Even those who hate you.
I'm not what you think I am, Darren. My father...
You have the sash now.
As Darren spoke, Kenton reached for his sand, cupping a tiny handful in his palm and staring at it solemnly. How could he tell Darren his power was exhausted? How could he be a Sandmaster in name only?
Grains of sand will only flow with the wind, Kenton. Never against them.
Of course, Darren. You're right.
With barely a thought, Kenton called the sand in his hand to life, surprising even himself.
What the...
The light of mastered sand instantly banished the alley's shadows. His fist glowed red as he clutched the sand, letting it seep between the cracks in his fingers to form a ribbon that wove a simple pattern in the air. The feeling he had noticed earlier, before Chris had interrupted him, was still there. The sand felt weak, Still, despite the odd feeling, the experience of mastering sand was the same as it had always been. It sung to him, this sand, sung in his mind and in every fiber of his being. 8 years now he had worked with the sand, coaxing every ounce of power from its grains, driving it faster, controlling it with more delicacy, all because he had wanted to prove those above his father wrong, and never because of the sand itself. And that was why it had failed him when he had needed it to save his life. But now he could see it, feel it inside, like a childhood song he thought he had forgotten. It was beautiful, shimmering with radiance, twisting and spinning in the air.
Three ribbons? You've made three ribbons, Kenton! Can you do that? I didn't think you could...
Nor did I, but I was wrong. Now, let's go.
And with that, he stepped forward, his three ribbons of sand whirling around his body. The crowd parted as Kenton hovered among them, carried a few feet from the ground by his swirling ribbons of sand. Deeren hurried to keep up.
What did you plan to do?
It's time I became a sandmaster.
Is that Kenton?
I'm right behind you, Kenton.
Just keep up. Time is of the essence.
Years as the DM's favored topic of rumors had prepared Kenton to be the center of attention, and he ignored the people as he rose above the steps to the Blackstone Hall of Judgment, while Deren trailed somewhat less confidently in his wake. Two tracts, dressed in formal Black Hall uniforms, crossed their spears before Kenton, blocking his path to the doors.
Halt! The council is in session, the hall is closed.
Not to a mastrel.
There aren't any mastrels left.
Look again.
As he spoke, Kenton allowed one of his glowing ribbons to flip on the sash.
What? A golden sash? I thought...
He's a master. We have to let him through.
Kenton was stunned. He had been expecting to argue his way into the hall. All his life he had needed belligerence and stubbornness to gain even the slightest concession. Yet two simple statements had won this conversation. Perhaps there was something to be said for authority after all. Directly before them was another set of doors, these open, with another pair of tracts guarding them. Beyond those doors was the judgment room, which took up the bulk of the hall's space. Inside that room, he would find the Taishin, leaders of the eight professions. Well, seven, since there was no Lord Mastral.
Can we just walk in like this?
Come on, I've done this before.
Each year, when Praxton had refused to grant Kenton mastrelship, Kenton had appealed the decision to the council. He was very familiar with the Taishin and their ways.
This place is amazing. I've never been inside before.
It's supposed to impress. Sandmasters built all of this centuries ago.
How incredible!
The buildings, sources of law and justice in Los End, were regarded with nearly as much reverence as Kirstian temples. As Kenton strode forward, he tried to gather his optimism. All four times he had appealed to the council, they had denied him with 7-1 decisions. He suspected that after 4 years of useless appeals, made only to spite his father, the Taishin were growing tired of him. A functionary looked up from her desk as Kenton and Deren approached the doors into the debating chamber.
May I help you, young gentleman?
Announce my arrival to the chamber.
I can't interrupt. Mastral Dryle has the floor.
Kenton strode past the minor functionary's desk, marching into the main judgment chamber.
Then you can announce me after I arrive.
Wait. Allow me.
With foot traffic at the boat race and the main markers continuing to rise.
Shaped like an inverted pyramid, the chamber had a central platform for testimonies, surrounded by three sloping walls filled with seats. Nearly every chair was filled. Hall seats, especially in Khazar, were expensive commodities. It was more than the privilege of watching judgments. A seat in the hall was a sign of prestige and importance, even if they were purely spectatorial in nature. Kelzin, influential profession members, as well as public officials, vied for the places ferociously.
Wait here.
Fine, but be quick.
The only people in the room who really mattered were the Taishin. Eight raised chairs stood on the far wall directly in front of the testimony platform. Seven were filled. One was empty. Kenton's eyes sought a place on the second wall about midway up, where the mastrels usually sat. The chairs sat empty, like an open sore in the otherwise packed wall of people. A familiar form stood on the platform addressing the conference. A face of dark scars beneath tattered robes. The man's ugliness could be recognized even from a great distance. Nilto, so-called Lord Beggar, leader of the unofficial Ninth Profession. What reason would he have to make testimony during proceedings held to ratify a new Lord Mastral?
I thank you for your time, my honorable friend.
Nilto finished his arguments, stepping off the platform and heading straight for the doors. It seemed the Lord Beggar had other places to be. As he did, the flustered functionary hurried over to address the Taishin.
Announcing Mastral Kenton of the Diem, son of the late Lord Praxton, and a, representative of the Sand Profession.
Ha ha ha! Ah, dear Kenton of the Diem! Oh, back to bother the council again. Oh, I always knew that something as paltry as death would never be enough to keep you from annoying us.
Kenton smiled. At the far end of the line of Taishin, in the least respected and often ignored council seat, lounged a man in ridiculous violet robes with a frilly white shirt underneath. The cuffs of the shirt were undone and were stained with droplets of wine. He was an older man, perhaps in his late 40s. His face could have been a respected face. It had strong features and almost a venerable quality. The face, however, betrayed the rosy cheeks and red nose of drunkenness. This was Delius, the Lord Admiral, the embarrassment of Lossand. Lady Judge Helas, a woman in her 60s who headed the Taisha Council, looked at Kenton with disdain.
Lord Admiral, please.
I apologize for my tardiness, Lords and Lady Taishin.
The woman knew Kenton well from their previous encounters, liked him even, or so he had thought. Her look, however, could wither a dorim vine.
Kenton, this is most irregular. We have already heard from Dryal on behalf of the Sand Profession.
I apologize again, Lady Judge, but I am sure that the council can see what I am wearing and understand what it means.
The sash?
Yes. Mastral Dryal has no claim on the leadership of the Diem. That honor falls to me as its most senior member.
Poised among the Mastral section of the Great Hall, Dryal's eyes narrowed.
Lies! Must we listen to this?
Dryal, still your tongue. You have had your say.
Kenton saw now that, as Diren had suggested, Dryal was accompanied by several acolytes who appeared loyal to him. Lady Judge Helas turned to her fellow Taishin, encouraging them to speak. Lord Regent, the head of the tower, Lossand's military, was the first to do so.
This is most irregular, Kenton. The other Sandmasters said nothing of this.
The other Sandmasters didn't know about it, Lord Regent. They didn't hear the Lord Mastral advance me. Those who survived the attack were standing too far back to hear anything.
Convenient.
As he spoke, Kenton had the uncanny sense of hearing his own words as an outsider.
They don't believe me. I can read it in their expressions. I have petitioned the Taishin too many times with frivolous claims, challenging my father's authority. Now, they view me as a time waster and a petulant child.
I'm afraid you have come here under a false assumption, Kenton. These proceedings are not to ratify a new Lord Mastral.
No? Then what?
Even after the raid, this thieves' den still looked like any other building to Ace. It was carved of stone and sand, run down and tired like so much of the city, in need of repair. Inside, it was empty and dirty and smelly, rank with the stench of men and of heat.
This way. Come along.
Keep your hands laced behind your head.
Sure. Just quit shoving, Tract.
There were uniformed Tracts posted outside. Her men, guarding the doors now that the place had been opened wide, and a handful of thieves too slow to escape the raid were ushered out as the crowds watched.
Ma'am?
Ace had returned to supervise the cleanup operation, having handed Lochmlin over to her men outside. Ace entered and quickly mounted the stairs. Inside, more uniforms were searching the messy room. Stolen wares nestled along its scarred walls.
Let's get this moving. Come on, get your backs into it.
Three Tracts worked to move a cupboard away from one wall.
On three. One, two,
three!
Ma'am, I think you'll want to see this.
What is it, Jarsk?
The tract called Jarsk beckoned her over to a set of doors that had been deftly disguised by the use of paint and sand so as to blend in with the wall where they hid behind the cupboard.
What is that? A door?
It was hidden behind the cupboard, ma'am, when we moved it.
Fine. Well, open it. Let's see what Lachlan was hiding.
Great Sandlord.
Through the open door, the tracts saw a grimy, windowless storeroom that was little more than a cupboard. The room had been turned into a cell, and within there were bodies, accompanied by the stench of human waste. Sitting there amongst the bodies was a man, his body emaciated through lack of food, a scrabbly beard on his chin. His once colorful robes were stained with blood and worse. The man looked up as the door opened, any sign of hope all but gone in his eyes.
Hello?
Who is that? Your name, man.
Beside the man were the decomposing bodies of a woman and two children, both of them under 10 years of age. It was hard not to stare at the long, dried blood on their clothes.
Jarsk, I'll speak to him.
Ace stepped into the room, crouching before the disheveled figure who sat amidst the grisly scene.
You, man. What is your name? What are you doing here?
Torkoal. Will you... Please, will you... kill me now?
No, friend. I am Senior Tract Ace, and these are my men. We're here to help you.
Torkoal? Where do I know that name?
He was an advisor to the Lord Merchant. Went missing in a boating accident last year along with his family.
Sad Lord, preserve us.
You were presumed dead, Torkoal. You're a very lucky man.
Luckier than his family, at least, was the thought that no one dared to voice.
Who did this to you, Torkoal?
Shere Zan. We had an arrangement until...
Until?
I just wanted to walk away with my dignity, but no one may walk away from Shere Zan.
Ma'am, I've called the healer.
Good.
As her men tended to the tortured merchant, Ace's hand clenched into a fist so tightly that it threatened to draw blood from the palm of her hand. First Jadan and his men, now this.
I will find Shere Zan. Or should I say, Nilto. By the Sandlord, I will catch this devil.
Hearing this, the tract called Tain, who had followed her into the room, nodded at her vow. With Jadan gone, Tain was her second. He would be the closest confidant on the Shere Zan case.
We're getting close. We must be.
Chris's estimation of Khazar proved correct in one area, at least. It was crowded. Chris and the others practically had to fight to move through the mass of people.
Oh, it's hard to believe that such a hideous city was my late Prince Gavaldon's destination. It's so overcrowded.
The city is well placed, Duchess. Hard to attack, easy to defend. Thus it thrives, and success and safety attract people.
The first few minutes were horrible. Chris was accustomed to people giving her a great deal of room. She was, after all, of noble blood. The Daysiders didn't seem to care about her personal space. They jostled, shoved, and bumped into her.
Oh!
The smell of their dirty, unwashed bodies was nearly enough to knock her unconscious. Fortunately, she had Bayon. Whether he noticed the look on her face, or whether he simply guessed she would need room, Bayon suddenly began to make space where there had previously been none. People shoved, he shoved harder. People pushed, but he was much taller and more massive than anything Lawsand could produce. People began to notice for the first time that the body they were shoving was much larger than what they were accustomed to, and their eyes opened wide with amazement as they turned up to stare at the massive black-skinned giant that stood in their midst. Within a few moments, the crowd had pulled back, flowing around Bayon like raging waters before an enormous stone. Chris and Cinder crouched in Bayon's wake.
Oh, thank you.
Come on, we'll lose our guide.
Where's Akron?
There.
Akron's large head could be seen bobbing happily underneath a colorful canopy. A moment later, Akron pushed his bulk back in their direction. When he met up with them, he wore one of the Kirstian forehead medallions just above his brow.
You should never have given him any money, my lady.
You have no taste for other cultures, Professor.
On the contrary, I'm happy to observe, just not to go native.
Akron gestured to his forehead.
How is that? Do I look like a local?
Very much so.
Keep moving, both of you.
Their diminutive guide waited impatiently just beyond the line of tall shops with colored canopies.
This way, and try to keep up this time.
The thin streets and tall buildings granted plenty of shade as relief from the sun, but Chris wondered how anyone could survive in a city so crowded. The streets weren't cobbled. They didn't need to be. The ground appeared to be solid rock, though there were patches and drifts of sand hiding in corners and alleys. The canopies and drapings were more colorful than what she had seen in the Kirstian towns of the Kurla. Of course, the colors were still far from as vibrant as those of Darkseid, but only so much could be done with the bright sun bleaching everything over time. Their urchin of a guide, perhaps 12 years old and as suspicious as she was bored, led them gradually toward the center of the island. The land sloped upward as they walked, but before they could reach a point where Chris could overlook the city, their guide stopped and turned down a particularly narrow alleyway.
This is a good place for an ambush.
Who would want to ambush us?
I'm just making an observation.
But the warrior strode into the alleyway with one hand resting on his sword hilt. Chris followed, as did the others. A few feet down the alleyway, their guide turned and walked through what must have been an open doorway in one of the walls.
Now, where did she go?
When Chris arrived, she discovered that the doorway looked something more like a tunnel, a vaguely squarish opening cut in the stone wall. It was large, wide, and tall enough to accommodate even Bayon and Akron without trouble.
Have arrived. Lanzer, like promised. Two luck for Pac-Man.
Where are we?
Lanzer.
What is Lanzer?
Place you were going? Per Pac-Man.
Chris frowned, peering through the dark opening. There appeared to be shadowed forms moving deep within the tunnel. Perhaps Bayon was right. Maybe it was an ambush. Then she realized something, or rather, she heard something, a few words echoing through the stone tunnel.
He said he could wrestle 10 sandlings and still not be out of breath.
And you believed him?
How could I not? He was a lot bigger than me, my friend.
Those people in there, that's dynastic. They're speaking dynastic.
Reassured, she removed her dark glasses and stepped into the tunnel.
Come on!
The Pac-Men, however, stayed where they were. The four sets of saddlebags remained on the ground.
Won't enter. Too dark. We aren't blind like you.
Blind?
Lonsha. Many of the Dayside texts use that word for darksiders. It means blind ones.
That's silly.
So are people. Therefore, it makes sense that they would use the term.
Won't enter. I go, but Pac-Man stay.
All right.
She poked through the coins Kenton had given her, choosing two of the red-colored ones she had determined were worth the least. Apparently, these were lax.
Here, guide, can you explain that I am paying them?
You will find that money is a universal language, my lady.
Huh.
Indeed, the Pac-Man accepted the coins and, without bowing a proper farewell, turned and left down the alleyway.
40 lakh? Look!
She overpaid? Good. Drinks are on me.
Launches know nothing. Their eyes can't see. Coins all look the same.
They certainly seem cheerful.
Maybe they're happy in their work?
Maybe. Is this place what I think it is?
We'll find out in a moment.
Bayon struggled to pick up all four sets of bags.
Akron, help him!
What? Oh! Of course.
The hefty professor moved to accept one set of bags, slinging them over his shoulders like a scarf.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome.
They entered the tunnel. They rounded a corner and entered a short-ceilinged room, or cavern. Chris couldn't tell which it was. It was filled with shops and people, much similar to the market they had just left, except for several major differences. All of the signs were written in Dynastic, and all the people had dark skin. Chris stared at the scene with amazement.
Darksiders!
Everywhere!
It's incredible!
Professor?
Culturally, I mean.
Indeed, Darksiders mingled and mixed here, traveling from shop to shop, bargaining for familiar foodstuffs and other items Chris hadn't seen since they had begun their voyage months ago. The walls were hung with colorful lanterns, illuminating the large room with soft hues that were just the right level of brightness, and the air was cool and wet, at least compared to that outside.
Oh, it's... we're home!
It is reminiscent of Ellis, like a...
a magical door to home.
It is amazing. A linguistic enclave.
You mean a cultural enclave, Professor Sender?
We're not going to have this discussion again, are we, John?
They're maintaining culture first. Language is only a byproduct.
Yes, well, I'm a linguist. That means I get to name it.
Hush, both of you. This is... it's where Gavin would surely have come.
As she walked, Chris identified at least a half dozen different accents. Each region of Darkside had its own distinct way of speaking Dynastic.
Aerians, Tayak people? No Elysians that I can see.
No.
The black-skinned Iarians were the largest and most powerful nation under Dynastic control, while the Tayak states were a group of Dynastic protectorates that lay huddled along Darkside's eastern shore.
If anyone would want to escape Darkside, it would be the Tayak. Their fertile flatlands hold some of the most overworked, most secluded people in the dynasty.
No guns here, you'll notice.
No. But from what I've heard, the dynasty barely lets the Tayok have horse-drawn plows, let alone firearms.
This place should not exist.
The dynasty wants us to think it doesn't exist. They don't want us to know that there is traffic between the continents.
She turned to their guide.
How do they get their goods in Tis?
Shipments come every month.
So what is this place?
Darksider Village. Darksiders live here.
I can see that. Is there someone in charge? Someone who might keep track of Darksiders who pass through the town?
Can help, yes. Cost 10 lakh.
You little cheat. We already paid once.
Need it, so you pay again.
She'd make a good mercenary.
Chris counted out 10 more coins.
Here.
Once paid, the girl immediately began to move, dashing through the crowd. At first, Chris thought she was running away with the money, but then the girl paused, turning restlessly and waiting for them to follow.
Come!
Our guide's not prone to extended bouts of patience, is she?
No, she isn't. Did you resolve your discussion with Professor Akron?
No, but I did manage to confuse him enough that he thinks I won. Shall we go?
Chris led the group through the darkened, cavern-like space toward their guide. As soon as they got close, the girl scurried away again, but Chris refused to let herself be hurried.
The more I see of it, the more I believe we're in Darkside. But is that foolish?
We crave familiarity. It's how cultures exist and replicate to reinforce such trappings.
Safety here is an illusion, Duchess. Remember that.
The room resolved into corridors that almost seemed like streets. The floor was cobbled, even though it probably didn't need to be, and in some of the larger areas there were even lamp poles bearing oil lanterns. Chris still couldn't tell if they were underground or not. Some of the walls were unworked stone, but occasionally she would see small patches of light above, as if the ceiling were constructed of wood. The place seemed to be a combination of caverns, both natural and man-made. Most of the walls were obscured, however. Buildings had been built up against them. The line of houses and shops didn't even have alleys between them. They kind of reminded Chris of tenements back in the poorer sections of Elis, though many of these buildings looked rich and well-constructed.
It's such a huge space. Magnificent!
The underground system was even larger than Chris had assumed. Their guide led them through at least a dozen different chambers and tunnels. Overall, it was probably as big as a couple of city blocks back in Elis, though it was much more spread out because of the tunnels. Eventually, they passed through what was probably a residential section, Darkside fungal flowers growing in rows outside the front doors. The tunnel eventually narrowed to one last door, sitting solitarily in a rock face. Like some of the buildings, this one actually seemed to be cut into the stone wall. Their guide led them to another alleyway.
Man you need is this way.
Those are dark side flowers. Do you see, Senna? They must have been imported specially.
Yes, it's fascinating. See the doors here? This must be a residential area, located right off the main trading square.
Must be very convenient.
A necessity, too. Space is at a premium in an enclave of this nature. To hear a familiar song.
Culture is more than language, Professor. How many times must I stress that?
The alley narrowed toward a sheer rock face, within which, almost hidden, was another door. Antis stopped the others before she entered the door at the end of the alley.
Here, you wait.
Antis disappeared from view as the door closed.
I didn't cross the ocean to visit Darkside. We already came from there. The outside is much more interesting. Look at this trinket I picked up on one of those stalls out there.
The professor showed the medallion he'd had tied to his forehead. The meaning of the symbol was a mystery to all of them.
Of course, this isn't Darkside, John. It's a new culture, one in the process of blending. I wouldn't be surprised to find a contact language developing. A pigeon between Dynastic and Lawson.
The door opened to reveal a Darkside woman with a sword at her side and a grim expression on her face. Bayon immediately spotted that she wore a pistol as well, its bulge neatly disguised by her robes.
You may enter.
At the instruction, Chris's party passed through the door in the rock face. Accompanied by the swordswoman, they entered a corridor lit by lanterns, whose walls were constructed from carapace. It was plain and unfurnished, and felt rough and cold.
See, Duchess? 10 lakh well spent.
A thick, ornate door stood at the end, guarded by another Darksider who wore a sword at his belt. He pointed to Chris.
Only you. Now, Duchess, I must advise caution.
It's all right, Bayon. I'll be fine.
Chris entered the doorway alone. She entered a grand room with an ornate fireplace. The fire was masked behind a protective plate of glass with a decorative grill. The walls were hung with paintings, and a massive rug covered the floor. There were several plush Darkside chairs beside the fireplace, one of which was occupied by a bulbous man wearing a very expensive Darksider suit, cut with no tails on the coat, and a girdle instead of a vest, a style fashionable a few seasons ago. His skin was darkest black. Their guide, Ntis, was curled up in another chair, sipping on a warm drink, watching suspiciously as Chris entered. She tried to take it all in.
Ah, this must be our missing Elysian Duchess. I am pleased to see you survive the trip unharmed.
You know me?
All of you, my dear, all of you. Though we expected you weeks ago. Come, sit.
Chris saw the man more clearly as he turned, and her eye was drawn to a distinctive scar on his neck. It was star-shaped and ran from his neck up his face almost to his ear. The only person she knew of with such a scar was...
Lothan! You're Lothan!
So I'm often accused. And of course, I can't deny it. Please, Duchess Chrysala, sit down.
Before his fall from grace, Lothan had been the Emperor's chief minister of diplomacy. Chris took the seat opposite Lothan.
You're infamous on Darkside, you know. Traitor to the dynasty, executed, or so we're told, for trying to murder Emperor Skathan himself.
Is that what they say?
It is.
Lothan poured tea for her from an ornate pot, smirking. This was his domain, and it was clear that he felt invincible here.
But how do you know who I am?
We are not completely isolated from our homeland. Information has a way of finding us.
My expedition was supposed to be secret.
Little is secret from the dynasty, dear Duchess. Especially the doings of its enemies. But must we talk politics? I came here to escape such things. That and to retain my head in its proper position atop my neck. You want news of Gavin, I assume.
My betrothed is dead. That news reached me a long time ago, and I am past mourning. I'm here to find the weapon he sought.
You don't drink your tea, dear Duchess. I thought cinnamon was a favorite in Ellis.
It is. But I've never liked my tea too hot.
Wise. You wouldn't want to burn yourself.
Chris knew that he was a master of the social subtleties which thrived in the Emperor's court. And so, as they spoke of tea, she felt certain that he was also telling her something else, warning her of danger. But of what? Just outside, Chris's companions were becoming anxious.
Time waiting is time wasted. Do you think the dear Duchess will be long?
Professor Cinder glanced at the two armed guards.
I suggest you temper your patience, Professor, lest you feel the press of cold blade through flesh.
Yes, I see what you mean.
As was his nature, Bayon kept his own counsel on the matter, watchful of his surroundings.
My prince sought a weapon, Lothan. If you know how he died or what he found, then I need to know. I will pay you, if you like, for the information.
Money and information are really quite similar, you know. Both are extremely valuable, but neither would be worth anything if everyone had all they desired. Both can also get you killed if you let it be known that you have too much.
Meaning?
Meaning, dear Duchess, that there are certain things I am not at liberty to reveal.
Chris rose in her chair to accuse Lothan.
You know what Gavin found here, don't you?
After a fashion.
But why can't you speak openly? He is dead, and I am his representative now. Prince Gavaldon will not advise nor chastise you from the grave.
I've already told you that there are certain secrets I am required to keep.
Required by whom?
Myself. I don't mean to frustrate you, but I have learned through experience that rash words can be inconvenient.
Chris sat again, resigning herself to the circular talk of the Emperor's court.
Oh, what can you tell me then?
Not much. I will let you know, however, that your prince gave up his goal.
Then he must have made it to Khazar. He wouldn't give up hope unless he saw for himself that the Sand Mages weren't real. And you must have met him. You called him Gavin. Not Givaldin, his proper name. Gavin is what he tells people to call him, but only in an informal setting, like a comfortable room, sitting before a fireplace, perhaps?
Lothan nodded just once, a smile crossing his features.
And I thought you were supposed to be bad at this. Yes, Gavin did make it to Khazar, and I have spoken with him after a fashion. But that was a long time ago.
And where is he now? At least tell me that.
I told you, dear Duchess, I am not quite certain. Do not be despondent, my dear. I am not a heartless man. Seeing you are relatively inexperienced with Dayside, I will assign one of my best people to aid you.
He indicated the girl who had already acted as their guide here.
In teeth.
Oh, no. I'm not going to lead these fools around the city, Lothan. Find someone else.
You're a Darksider? I thought she was just an urchin guide.
To be frank, we're not sure what Antis is. She claims to be half Darksider, half Curtsian, and half Losandin, though she obviously never claims to be good at mathematics.
You're bad for business, Lothan.
As Antis glowered at Lothan, a door opened across the room. Chris looked up. She saw a ragged figure enter. The man was dressed in dirty clothes and walked with a limp. His skin color was difficult to define because his face was a mass of scar tissue with just one eye showing, bulging and red, while the other had completely scarred over. Though he stood in the shadows, the medallion on his head shone in the firelight, the sign of the Kirstian merchant class, similar, in fact, to the one Akron had purchased not an hour earlier.
Who is the woman? A visitor from Darkseid, Nilto, my friend. A rather important person. A ruler on her side of the world.
Get